How shall we study our Old Testaments? This is part six. Three changeless ingredients for a fruitful life. I don't know if you remember, I don't blame you for not holding it all in your mind, but we've looked at two of them. The Word of God. Remember, Joshua, be courageous. This Word in your mouth. Be very courageous. Don't turn from the left to the right. And we talked about why there was a need for courage. Well, it's a courageous thing not to be influenced by the crowd, not to be influenced by the majority, to be in a situation where most of the pull is in the opposite direction and you want to stand up and plant the flag for biblical truth and revelation. And the Christian faith, it takes a fair degree of courage. We spent one Sunday night basically on that. The authoritative word, the continuing power of God. There's Joshua down fighting the Amalekites. Remember, Aaron and Hur up on the mountain. And when the hands go up, they succeed. And when the hands come down, they fail. And so Joshua starts to put this together. The reason for their success isn't just military might, but the power of God. Third thing we're going to look at, the presence of God, the constant presence of God. I know what you're thinking, but there's a difference. Difference between power and presence. It's a subtle difference, but it's important. God's power is his presence manifested. It's his presence made visible. But his presence is just, it's his person. And he's frequently doing important things just in being with us that can be easily missed. And that's what I want to look at tonight, the continuing presence of God. Joshua chapter 5, verse 1. I'm going to read a fairly lengthy text, and then we'll talk about it together. Joshua 5, 1, and I'm going to go right through the fifth chapter, pretty much. As soon as all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west, and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea, as soon as they heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan for the people of Israel until they had crossed over, well, their hearts melted, and there was no longer any spirit in them because of the people of Israel. At that time, the Lord said to Joshua, "Make flint knives and circumcise the sons of Israel a second time." And so Joshua made flint knives and circumcised the sons of Israel at Gebeth Haraloth. And this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. Because it could make you say, why? Why are we doing this? All the males of the people who came out of Egypt, all the men of war, had died in the wilderness on the way after they had come out of Egypt. Though all the people who came out had been circumcised, yet all the people who were born on the way in the wilderness, remember 40 years, after they had come out of Egypt, had not been circumcised. I mean, how big a deal can that be? 6, for the people of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness until all the nation, the men of war who came out of Egypt, perished. Because they did not obey the voice of the Lord. The Lord swore to them that he would not let them see the land that the Lord had sworn to their fathers to give to us, a land flowing with milk and honey. Remember the 12 spies? They go in, 10 come back, can't do this. No way we can do this. I know God promised, I know God said, forget what God said, we can't do this. Joshua and Caleb are the only two who said they could do it. The people wanted to stone Joshua and Caleb just for suggesting that they could do it. God judged them. They weren't allowed to enter. 40 years wandering in the wilderness because of that failure. 7. So it was their children, whom he raised up in their place, that Joshua circumcised. For they were uncircumcised because they had not been circumcised on the way. When the circumcising of the whole nation was finished, they remained in their place in camp until they were healed. And the Lord said to Joshua, "Today I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you." What is that? What's it have to do with circumcision? And so the name of that place is called Gilgal to this day. While the people of Israel were encamped at Gilgal, they kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month in the evening on the plains of Jericho. Remember what happened at Jericho a little later on. And the day after the Passover, on that very day, they ate of the produce of the land, unleavened cakes, parched grain, And the manna ceased the day after they ate of the produce of the land. And there was no longer manna for the people of Israel. But they ate the fruit of the land of Canaan that year. And talk about that. When Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted up his eyes and looked. He's walking. He's walking alone, you'll see. And he's thinking about Jericho. This is the first obstacle in their way. When Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man was standing before him with his drawn sword in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, "Are you for us or our adversaries?" And he said, "No." That's an interesting answer. Are you for us or for our adversaries? No. No what? No, but I am the commander of the army of the Lord. Now I have come. Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshiped and said to him, "What does my Lord say to his servant?" Then the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, "You've heard these words before. Take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy." And Joshua did so. Now Joshua was shut up inside. Now Jericho, was shut up inside and outside because of the people of Israel. No one went out, no one came in. And the Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand with its king and mighty men of valor." I know I read a long passage. I think it's rich with lessons. Both Joshua and the people, they find themselves in a place they've never been before. They've not done this before. This is all new. They're entering into the promised land, just getting into the promised land. They're entering into all that God had promised for them. Everything else up to this point had just been preparatory for this momentous day. They're stepping into God's will. What happens when people choose in some specific area, maybe for the first time or later on in the Christian life, when people choose to follow the Lord? What happens when his call has been heard, perhaps resisted at points like that wandering generation in the wilderness, but finally, spiritually awake, courage is summoned, self is dethroned? What lies inside the will of God for those who want to walk in his fresh, living way for their life? Joshua is, for the very first time, looking at life from inside the promised land. None of them had done this before. Looking at life from inside the promised land. He's at that point you and I have been at. He made the decision. He made the start. He's in for the duration. And now it's time to start. Now it's time to get into it. And the first thing you find out is fresh call, fresh start, fresh opposition. That's what he sees right off the bat. The doubters, the deniers, they've all died off in the wilderness. That whole 40-year stretch, I'm sure Joshua never forgot it. Now he's in the promised land. And he's going to find challenges aplenty. We don't know the whole account, everything that went on in Joshua's mind, but I'm sure he must have had his doubts and fears. But then he would pause and he would remember the cost of not following the call of God. And he would remember every time he looked over at his friend and fellow spy, Caleb, every time the two of them got together, remembering the extreme cost of turning back from God's will and way. He had buried a whole generation of doubters in the wilderness. And so now the test comes. It's always the way it is. How does one start to deal with the problems and challenges that are set out against anyone's progress in the Christian walk? The passage, I think, can offer us some practical help. One, understanding God's heart, even when his ways seem strange. There are several lessons in the first 12 verses of chapter 5, so 1a. Notice that the manna from heaven stopped as soon as they were obedient and into the promised land. Verse 12, and the manna ceased the day after they ate of the produce of the land. There was no longer any manna for the people of Israel, but they ate the fruit of the land of Canaan that year. Must have been confused. I mean, we see the whole story. You've got it all written out in a way that they didn't. It had to seem strange at first. Why would this wonderful provision stop the moment they were freshly obedient and entering into the full promise of the Lord? I mean, God, think about it. God provided manna for that disobedient generation of wanderers. He provided manna for them, and he removed it from the obedient generation that followed him and entered into the land. The naysayers, the grumblers, the complainers, the deniers in the wilderness, God fed them supernaturally. The faithful who were obedient, obeyed the Lord, entered the promised land, no more manna. These people were being weaned off of certain blessings to which they had grown accustomed. I wonder what went through their minds. Doesn't God love us anymore? Has God just abandoned us to suffer and struggle against all the foe and opposition in the land? Boy, life just doesn't seem the same without manna from heaven. Remember the good old days when we used to get manna from heaven every morning, wandering in the wilderness? What we don't hear said very often is sometimes blessings are removed as we spiritually mature. I think that's very important in understanding God's ways over a lifetime. The manna in the wilderness was never given as a reward of faithfulness or blessing. The people weren't faithful at all. They were needy. They were wanderers. They were nomads. They had no place to put down roots. But now they were in the promised land. This was to be God's home for them. He wants them to plant fields and grow crops. Now, let me ask you, were they likely to plow up fields, plant crops, and harvest them as long as God just kept giving them manna from heaven? I don't think so. And God's trying to mature them. He's trying to get them to enter into something that takes discipline, takes work, and these unexpected blessings just showering down on them all the time weren't going to help them grow. There will continue to be times of wondrous, miraculous intervention. We're going to see it in the Battle of Jericho. God will always be faithful and good. But that doesn't mean they're to interpret times when God doesn't miraculously intervene as though he's no longer interested, no longer present. That's a problem. He didn't answer this prayer. He didn't do this for me. I can't understand why he wouldn't. I've talked to people like that. I'm not going to church anymore. The manna stopped. Where'd God go? Why is he not doing these things for me anymore? B. New beginnings always call for fresh consecration. That's in verses 2 through 10. The early chapter, the early portion of chapter 6 just briefly hints, it just hints, I read it, that Jericho lies right at the doorway of possessing the land. So that means the children of Israel, their robes and shoes are barely dry from the muddy Jordan crossing, and they have enemies to fight. But there's something else they have to take care of first, and it must have seemed very impractical to them. Their greatest enemy isn't, first of all, outside Jericho. The greatest enemy is, first of all, inside. So God's first call isn't to military battle. They stopped to circumcise a whole new generation of males and celebrate the Passover as soon as they crossed the Jordan. Now think about that. We all know about the walls of Jericho falling. But what's the first step of victory in entering the promised land? What's the first step to defeating Jericho before they start marching around the walls? And surprisingly, it's not making spear and swords for battle. It's carving flint knives for circumcision. Yeah, circumcision, that painful, no fun sign of their belonging to God's covenant people. So in other words, before they would realize their ownership of the land, they would have to reestablish God's ownership of themselves as covenant people. You see the lesson there? God's power over their enemies isn't the issue. There is no doubt whatsoever about that. There is no doubt whatsoever about whether or not God's plan for them is right and good and doable and victorious. There's only one variable in this whole equation. The only thing that they need to worry about is God's ownership of them. Would they be faithful at all costs? That's the issue for these Israelites pressed home, because this is the only issue on which their ultimate victory will depend. I know we don't think of circumcision much in a religious sense, but I think we'll miss some important lessons if we ignore a few relevant texts. Let me just share a couple of them with you. The first one is Genesis 17, 7 through 9. Is that in your notes? Okay. God speaks. He's speaking to Abraham. And I will establish my covenant between me and you and your offspring after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant, to be God to you and your offspring after you. Now look, this is nowhere near on the horizon in terms of a timeline. And I will give to you and to your offspring after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. As for you, Abraham, you shall keep my covenant, you and your offspring after you throughout their generations. Now notice, even though this covenant was established with Abraham, God is already looking forward to their entering of the promised land. And the covenant was to be kept perpetually. Look at Exodus 12, 48 and 49. If a stranger shall sojourn with you and would keep the Passover to the Lord, let all his males be circumcised. Then he may come near and keep it, keep the Passover. He shall be as a native in the land, but no uncircumcised person shall eat of it. Notice they're circumcised as they cross into the promised land, and then they celebrate the Passover. No uncircumcised person shall eat of it. There shall be one law for the native, for the stranger who sojourns among you. So don't miss the key principle in these very old ancient words. No uncircumcised person was to partake of the Passover. Why? Well, the Passover celebrated God's deliverance from Egypt. That's what it was all about. It proclaimed God's delivering, keeping, protecting power, his miraculous power manifested on behalf of the people, delivering them from Egypt. And those who hadn't paid the price of dedication and obedience were not encouraged to think that they could casually receive God's gracious presence on their own terms. It had to be on God's terms. It still has to be on God's terms. So here they are. Joshua and people in this new land. A new generation has crossed with miraculous help. The Jordan River, it was a big moment. But then wait a minute. There's a whole generation that had grown up in the wilderness wanderings, and they were uncircumcised. Their fathers were. But they aren't. And they all need to learn the basic truth that while God is gracious, he's not like the tooth fairy. He works in terms of covenant faithfulness. So with all the hustle and bustle of entering the land, with all the challenges and battles, with laying claim to the land that must eventually be divided up, remember, among them all, God calls this generation to covenant with the Lord for themselves. What their fathers experienced was not going to carry them forward with God. They had to experience that for themselves. There's a real lesson in that. There's a real lesson in that. They must freshly present themselves to the Lord. This is significant. In our day, at least frequently, babies who are circumcised, it's not a religious thing. There's no decision and no memory. But most of Joshua's men were of fighting age. Joshua was told to make knives and circumcise the men, verse 2. Now, forgive me, but when you're an adult male, and somebody comes to you with a sharpened piece of flint rock to circumcise you, you study that situation a little bit. And you remember it. You remember it. One thing's for sure about circumcision. There's a world of difference between hearing about it, reading about it, maybe even agreeing with it, and experiencing it for yourself. And really, that's the whole point of this chapter. A whole generation had grown up wandering in the wilderness. Their fathers were obedient. Their fathers were circumcised. But they never were. And God brings them to this specific point. A point where nothing could touch them more closely. God calls them into covenant, a fresh relationship with him. I know it's an ancient text, but this is God's way of saying it's time to bring all this wandering to an end. Enter into covenant with me for yourself. This is a new land and a new time, and you will never conquer this land coasting on your old spiritual realities. You can't walk with me based on someone else's commitment. You can't walk with me based on someone else's commitment. Your fathers were circumcised. That's not you. That's not you. Point number two. The issue isn't whether God is with you. That's the way we like to think of it, especially when we talk about God's presence. The issue isn't whether God is with you. The issue is, are you with him? It's in that fifth chapter, verses 13 and 14, and we're going to be done in just a couple minutes. When Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man was standing before him with a drawn sword in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, are you for us or for our adversaries? He's a military man. That's a logical question. This guy's got a sword. And he said, no, but I am a commander of the army of the Lord, and now I have come. Joshua fell on his face to the earth, worshipped, and said to him, what does my Lord say to his servant? Our kind of media-driven version of Christianity sometimes makes big business of teaching people how to get every drop of blessing out of God. Your best life now. Tapping into everything good and happy, it's an obsession particularly with the North American church. But we encounter something fresh and sort of corrective, I think, in this account from Joshua 5. Joshua is out walking alone. He's near the city of Jericho, probably, the text doesn't say for sure, probably trying to figure out, what are we doing with Jericho? How are we going to get around this? As of yet, no instructions from the Lord. And as he walks with his head toward the ground, he encounters somebody standing before him with a drawn sword. And Joshua asks the obvious question, are you for us or against us? Joshua knows it's important to know who your friends are and who your enemies are, and he wants to know. This divine being gives an answer that immediately brings the real issue into focus. No, Joshua, that's not the issue. I'm a commander of the army of the Lord. Now I have come, 5:14. And we're meant to take note of the way this being just begins his response with that sharp no. No, that's not the issue. Joshua's question can't be answered without that no, because he's not asking the right question. Like us, Joshua wants to know if this being is on his side. And this commander of the army of the Lord doesn't take sides. He commands. People line up with him. He doesn't line up with people. God has made great promises to Joshua. He's also made great promises to you and to me. God has great capacity for deliverance and provision, but now the real issue boils up to the surface, right in Joshua's face. Does Joshua just want help, or does Joshua commit himself to being the servant? I am your servant, as he falls to the ground. I thought I was in charge here. I'm pretty talented at what I do. I'm pretty gifted at what I do. I'm pretty capable as a person. Oh, you're saying that's not the issue at all. I'm just your servant. Joshua's response is magnificent. Just says he fell on his face to the earth, worshiped, and said, "What does my Lord say to his servant?" Underline that word servant. I just mentioned it. There's the key to life under God's leading. Joshua, he's got plenty on his mind. He desperately needs the Lord's help right at this moment, but he's wise enough to know this won't be him at his best if he just tries to get God to put his muscle behind his own plans. And as Joshua spies out the city, makes his plans, the real course of events is going to unfold very differently than I'm sure he ever thought. And he never would have caught on had he not been content just to bow at his feet and say, what? Whatever you say. To underscore his submission to God in everything he will hear and obey, God repeats some very famous words to the new leader. Commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, "Take off your sandals from your feet." Take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy. Joshua's never been called to go through anything like what he's about to face. It's all new territory. Moses isn't there to help. And here's the lesson as he confronts the Lord's commander. See this? It's man-made. You and I walk around in them all the time, but just the foundation where we put our feet, it's man-made. And now Joshua is being told, you're never going to accomplish anything that I'm calling you to accomplish if you're standing on this. It's holy ground. It's all new. It's all fresh. And everything depends on you recognizing my presence, not your man-made foundation in life. Joshua, take off your sandals. Why? The place you're standing, it's a lot holier than you think. Tomorrow's going to be a big day for Joshua. Tomorrow is going to mark the first battle in the Promised Land. And when the heat is on, Joshua, don't rely on anything man-made or you're going to fail. All the people, all the surrounding nations are going to be watching Joshua and the people tomorrow. He knows that. They're all going to, because the text says they just heard about him crossing the Jordan and the nation's hearts melted, it says. Joshua knows whatever happens in Joshua, everyone's going to know. Everyone's going to see it. And so I just wonder, what do you think Joshua thought about when he went to bed that night? After this meeting with the commander of the Lord's army, take your sandals off. And then he hears the plan. We'll see it not next Sunday night, the one after. I wonder if he thought it was going to work. I'll tell you what I think he thought about. We never know for sure. I think he remembered a battle when he was a bit younger. It was against the Amalekites. He saw all over again what happened when Moses' hands were up in the air, opposed to what happened when they were down. And I think Joshua probably remembered to say his prayers that night for the next day's battle. And I think he probably thought of something else. I think he pondered long and hard about a day 38 years ago, to be exact, when God had a plan for another venture, the immediate taking of the Promised Land, and only Joshua and his good friend Caleb had the wisdom to just agree with God and do what God said. And I imagine Joshua just said, that's what we're going to do tomorrow. It's holy ground. We'll just do what God says. And then I think he smiled and went to sleep. That's what I think. Aren't we blessed to be able to look at a story like that? Here's a man God uses to lead a nation in so many different ways. We're just so blessed to be able to crack open an ancient text. Oh, this is how God does things. Oh, this is what we can learn.